Hi, everyone. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and my blog is cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And my name is Andrew, and my blog is thestopbutton.com.
And this is our little movie podcast where we talk about usually pairs of movies, double features. And this episode, being October, is the Halloween double feature of Beware the Blob, 1972, the sequel, direct sequel to the original 1956, I think, The Blob. And then the 1988 Blob remake directed by Chuck Russell. So as we usually do, we're going to do it in chronological order. We had both seen the Blob remake before, and, you know, I assume you've seen the original Blob at some point, right?
Yeah.
But I had never seen Beware the Blob, and I'd always been curious about it because I remember, like, you know, going through some old monster movie, guidebook and seeing a publicity still that was memorable of, like, a priest about to be consumed by the Blob, and he's holding up the cross to it, and, you know, the review in Psychotronic Guide or whatever it was just said, like, you know, Beware the Blob is bad. Don't see it. Avoid it at all costs. And having actually seen it now, I don't know. I got a few kicks out of it. I mean, the movie clearly doesn't give a hoot. It's directed by Larry Hagman, and apparently, according to the internet, the only reason this movie got made is because Larry Hagman, like, lived next door to Jack Harris, who produced the original, and he, like, said, "Hey, I've never seen The Blob," and he showed him his 16mm print, and then it was like, "You know what? Let's do another one. I'll do it for you, Jack." And Larry Hagman at this time, I mean, he's most famous for JR and Who Shot JR and Dallas and all that, but before that, he was just a comic actor. He had a regular character on I Dream of Jeannie. And so Beware the Blob is pretty much just a comedy with lots of guest stars. And even the poster kind of speaks to that, like, because the poster has all these stills of guys like Godfrey Cambridge, who was the star of The Watermelon Man, and Shelley Berman, who was kind of a Bob Newhart type of soft-spoken intellectual comic in the 60s. And Larry Hagman has a part in it, too. But it gets even weirder than that because, like, improv guru legend Del Close has a scene that was apparently made up on the spot where he's a bum and an uncredited Burgess Meredith is a bum, and they're just, like, drunkenly, you know, yelling at each other before the Blob shows up to eat them. Most of the movie just feels made up on the spot, and I guess the screenwriter was quoted at some point as saying, like, "Yeah, I wrote a script, but, you know, you get those guys together. They just made it up as they went along." Oh, Garrett Graham is in it. Like, he plays a guy at a party wearing a gorilla suit who, like, answers the phone and makes gorilla noises into it. It's that kind of movie. It's oddly enjoyable, though. I kind of hate to admit it, but it was. I felt like it was so bad. It was kind of fun.
I think that it felt a lot like. Yeah, it did feel like one of the 70s spoof movies, but I felt like Larry Hagman's incompetence just, it took 15 minutes for the movie to get started. And I'm just like, it's only 90. I shouldn't be, like, dying through this 15-minute thing. And
well, first of all, this is the only monster movie in history where the opening credits are a cute kitten frolicking in a field, right?
It's got to be. And
it opens, like, with this. It opens with this really catchy, jaunty tune that you should drop into this podcast episode somewhere, right here even. But it's like this peppy, up-tempo kind of synthesizer keyboard tune. And I guess it's playing on, you know, the memorable Blob theme song from the original Blob, which was written by Burt Bacharach. Like, you know, "Beware of the Blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through a door." And this is kind of like a synthesizer-y version of that without lyrics. Although it's credited the guy who did the music is credited in the opening titles as like having composed this song called Beware the Blob, but there's no song lyrics to Beware the Blob anywhere. I think it's just this instrumental tune. But holy crap, I've been humming it and whistling it for days. It's really dang catchy.
Yeah.
Not that that makes up for a lot, you know, all these other shortcomings, though.
I just felt like it reminded me of, I'm wondering if in what, like 81, when they were planning on doing Jaws 3, People Zero, somebody was like, oh shit, do you remember Beware the Blob? And they were like, oh God, that's, because it's like the big bus. I don't know. Airplane.
The Big Bus was like a parody of Damnation Alley type of post-apocalyptic movies, right?
No, it was just actually, it was more of, it's the Airplane before Airplane.
Okay.
It's got your huge 70s cast. It's got a runaway huge bus. And it's like, it's either a year before Airplane or 2 years before Airplane. And so it's sort of a forgotten Airplane type thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know, this just felt like a spoof, and I some of it should have been really funny, but I just,
yeah, it's kind of, I know you make a spoof because it, I think it was made at a weird time in like horror movie history where, you know, things were, movies in general were getting more explicit, but horror movies still can considered kind of like, you know, Saturday afternoon kiddie matinee fare. So
right.
The idea of a follow-up to The Blob, you know, they definitely took it as a goof, but they didn't think it through to, you know, really explicitly parody the conventions of 50s monster movies yet. It's more just like, let's remake the original, but let's have, you know, funny scenes in between and just little, you know, sketch bits, basically. Like, the bit with there's a scene where a hippie goes to get a haircut,
yeah,
from Shelley Berman, and it's kind of funny on its own, but you know, it's an excuse just to, you know, have the blob creep out of the sink where the hippie's hair is going to be washed, and then it eats him. And the movie's a lot like that. It introduces characters and the blob eats them in the same scene, and it's just a way for, you know, all of Larry Hagman's comic actor friends to get a paycheck. Not that that's the worst thing, again. Sometimes it's a little grating, and more annoying, sometimes these comic actors show up for scenes and then they don't get eaten by the blob. Like, there's a real missed opportunity where Dick Van Patten plays a scoutmaster, like a Boy Scout master early in the movie, and you're just waiting and waiting for the scene where the blob eats the Cub Scout troop, and it never happens.
No, and apparently he dies off screen because the Boy Scouts show up in the last scene, and they're like, we're fine. You should have seen what happened to Mr.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I guess that's kind of the age group it was going for, because it really is that It's not violent. It's not, there's no disturbing blob. I mean, the blob eating the cat is the most disturbing thing.
Yeah. Let's talk about just the first 10 minutes.
Yeah,
because
that's sort of
the whole movie in a nutshell. It's like, okay, the kitten in the field, the opening credits, the catchy synthesizer tune. And then Godfrey Cambridge is this Alaskan pipeline worker who has brought a piece of the blob back in a thermos for quote unquote the lab boys to look at. And he's been keeping it in his freezer at his house. And then his wife just takes it out and leaves it on the counter, and the top just pops off, literally, like the blob is pushing it open. It flops out. It lands next to the cute little kitten we saw from the credits. And then Godfrey Cambridge is camping indoors. He's got his teepee set up, and his wife is bringing him salmon egg sandwiches and beer. And he's you know, just being sloppy all over her because he's been in Alaska for whatever. And then the blob eats a kitten, and it's kind of sad. You know, it's not explicit. They basically, like, they had the kitten step in some Jell-O or whatever they were using, and then they reversed the footage to make it look like, you know, it was reaching up to grab the kitten's paw. But yeah, then the kitten dies off screen. You see like a fake cat tail being dragged out the window by some of that purple gelatin, and actually, it kind of looks like cranberry sauce more than anything in this one. But yeah, Dean Koondé actually put the cranberry sauce on the kitten. He's like credited for second unit animal photography.
And that's like 19, like,
yeah, it sets the tone. I mean, because you're watching Godfrey Cambridge and the woman playing his wife just kind of being silly and clearly making up their lines as they go along, and you're cutting back and forth between that and the blob's going to eat a kitten. That's really the tone of the movie, and that's the mood that it sets.
I feel like the only script parts they kept were for the leads, which is Robert Walker Jr. and some terrible girl. And they're the hippies who are really good friends with Godfrey Cambridge, which is really, like,
hard to believe.
It's hard to believe. And it sort of perfectly fits the fact that Hagman can't afford any establishing shots of anything. So they'll, like, go to the house and you're like,
well, they needed somebody to come to Godfrey Cambridge's house and see him being eaten by the blob, which is sort of like the one attempt at a disturbing moment. Like, it looks like they spent a couple of hours covering Godfrey Cambridge in cranberry sauce for that shot. But yeah, also in those opening 10 or 15 minutes, when he's relaxing at home, Godfrey sits in front of the TV and watches a scene from the original Blob, and he's watching Steve McQueen, and then you're like, wait a minute, they just established that this is a direct sequel. They actually, you know, thought to explain, because at the end of the original Blob, it gets dumped in the North Pole because its weakness is the cold. So you're like, is this a direct sequel? Is it a meta sequel? Is it just a straight up parody? And the answer is a little of all three. By the way, the guy who came up with the story or the original script for Beware the Blob titled it A Chip Off the Old Blob, and it was released under that title in some places.
Wow. Yeah, that's the other thing, is this did not have any not even American International would pick this up. Jack C. Harris released it himself. Okay.
The thing about Jack Harris that I want to mention, Jack H. Harris, and what kind of ties him into the transitional period of monster movies is kind of that he lived it, because, like, all I knew about Jack Harris is that he produced The Blob, and I sort of assumed that had to mean that he was like a Roger Corman type who produced a lot of monster movies, but he really didn't. Like, after The Blob, there was 4D Man and Dinosaurs within the next few years. And then he produced Equinox, which Criterion released a long time ago. And, you know, Equinox has been cited as like the inspiration for Evil Dead and all this stuff. It's a 1970 monster movie with a really metaphysical plot about alternate dimensions being broken through, and it has lots of old-fashioned monster effects in it. And Jack Harris it was kind of like a student film that he took and then gave them some money to shoot some more and stretch it out into feature length. And then after that, he does Beware the Blob, and then after that, he does Schlock. He produces Schlock, the John Landis monster movie parody, like a very explicit monster movie parody. So this was kind of the direction that he was going in. Oh, and then the year after that, he does the same thing for John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon that he did for Equinox. He takes Dark Star as this, you know, too long to be a short, too short to be a feature movie, and, you know, pays to have some more stuff shot so that it can be released theatrically. So, and then he really didn't do anything else except for producing, being a producer on the Blob remake, unbelievably enough. So, yeah, it's kind of like Jack Karras's relationship to monster movies was destined for self-parody. But it's also funny to think that he had such a – even though he produced so few movies, he played a really pivotal role for John Landis and John Carpenter shortly after Beware the Blob, like within the next couple of years, literally.
And Equinox, I remember Equinox was actually it has a big Criterion release.
Yeah, like a double disc Criterion release.
And you're just kind of like, well, that's kind of the thing about Beware the Blob is that nobody apparently wants to give this any time on this, even though when Burgess Meredith shows up, you're just kind of like,
am I hallucinating?
Yeah, it's just like Burgess Meredith is, and he's only in it for
a scene,
and it's like a 2-minute scene. It feels like about a 6-minute scene, and I think that's kind of my problem with Hagman is that he just lets everything go on and on and on, and I don't know if it's because he let everybody ad lib it or if it was just it's got to be a combination of general incompetence and that. But
well, I guess Del Close was just giving everybody improv lessons in between scenes, and that's how they figured they could keep things rolling.
Well, I feel like is it the first scene? It's definitely in the hobo scene. The actors are like saying to each other, well, what are you going to say next? And you're just like, oh, yeah. Yeah, they're like, well, what are you going to say next now? Because, what? And it happens a couple times in it, and the only times it doesn't happen is with the, like I said before, the lead guy and girl, and maybe the buffoonish, you find out, bowling alley owner. So there's like this really skeletal structure of the hippies and how they run afoul of the small businessman. And
it's like the same structure that the Blob and all the, you know, cheesy 50s monster movies had in terms of the monster, the authority figures, the disbelieving authority figures, and the, you know, young people who know the truth trying to warn everybody. But it does it without any kind of self-parody. The only real self-parody is that the town sheriff is played by Richard Webb, who is like a 1930s, 40s, 50s kind of square-jawed Chuck Connors type. He played Captain Midnight on television in the 50s, which was like, you know, Captain Video or any number of a really rinky-dink but much beloved Saturday or, you know, weekday afternoon shows that the first children of the television generation grew up on. And in the very last scene of Beware the Blob, he's making a speech which is clearly intended as a parody of the kinds of speeches that scientists give at the end of Roger Corman movies where they say, well, no one will ever know what this strange creature was that came to our planet. It very nearly could have destroyed us all. And yet, you know, we must struggle to overcome and to prepare for the future. You know, keep watching the skies. He's giving that kind of speech, and he doesn't notice that the blob is melting out of the ice that it's been frozen in, and it crawls up his leg. And then in a complete non sequitur, he looks at the camera and he goes, what? But he saw the blob on his leg, so that's not if the joke is that he's looking at us because he doesn't know the blob is on his leg and like, what are you staring at? That doesn't work if he notices. Oh, Larry, and then it ends with the end and with a question mark, just like the original Blob did.
There was a really good scene, and this will give you the example of how Hagman screws up so much that I keep blathering about. So the sheriff is outside and he's screaming to, he wants to light the bowling alley on fire while the hero is trying to freeze the blob, and he can't find a lighter. And so one of the Boy Scouts, who's always prepared, gives him a lighter. And then later on, when the sheriff is examining the frozen blob, the Boy Scout shows up for his lighter. And somehow Hagman did not know how to make that scene work. And it's like, who? So if the thing was ad-libbed, somebody was like, hey, JR, we need to have the guy come by, the kid come by, that'd be funny. And then he just doesn't know what to do when the kid gets there. And I saw that Larry Hagman had, like, his directing experience was from I Dream of Jeannie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of makes sense now.
Yeah, well, that's what he was doing before Dallas. You know, he was bad 60s sitcoms.
And it's kind of like it's that kind of direction, only... And some of it's obviously budget. There is never a establishing shot of the blob. It's always a, over-the-shoulder shot of the blob.
Or it's oozing through a grate or whatever.
And, I mean, the film stock's terrible. What's that movie that... It shot... It was Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. People thought Killer Tomatoes had a higher budget, and it was like, no, they just lucked into better film stock. And this is just filmed on really crappy stock. Like, nobody's ever remastered this thing. So even though Larry Hagman doesn't have any establishing shots because he's throwing together L.A. locations...
And, you know, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes isn't even, like, a clever deconstruction of monster movie tropes or anything. But, you know, it kind of has more of the right idea than Beware the Blob does.
And I feel
it has a little more courage in its silliness than Beware the Blob. Like, because Beware the Blob is silly on the level that, like, it'll cut to a Turkish guy taking a bath.
Oh, God. With his dog and his chocolate.
And then he, you know... I can't remember what happens. He sees the blob outside his window or something, so he runs down the street naked.
No.
And then
it eats his cat. It.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of cat killing. A lot of blob on cat violence in this thing.
Yeah. And then he runs down the street naked, gets pulled over by the dumbest cop in the world, who takes him back to the station where you meet the other dumb cop, and it's kind. In some ways, I was actually thinking about it earlier today that some of the humor is the humor about how they deal with race in this is very like what people complain about Seth MacFarlane race humor these days, because they're like, no, it's funny because like we're pointing out that they're racist, like that's the joke, you know, like.
What scene are you thinking of?
Well, I mean, the whole what's-his-face in the first scene.
Godfrey Chambers,
I was shocked to see that Godfrey Chambers is considered one of the four most important black comics of the 20th century.
He's considered, like, you know, on the level of... At the time, he was considered on the level of Cosby.
And, you know, his wife is, like, really with it, and he's just, like, this bumbling, drunken, like... She's just like, wait, what? But no, later on, I'm actually thinking of the scene where the deputy the black deputy makes some comment to the sheriff, and the sheriff's response is something like, well, that's why I's the sheriff and you's the deputy. And I was just like, I don't really think you guys got that. Or like all the hippie jokes. And it's just like...
Well, the hippie joke... Yeah, there's more hippie jokes than any other kind of joke in this movie. The aforementioned hippie gets a haircut scene. You can just picture them sitting around writing, you know, coming up with that, like, it's his first haircut and his last haircut. Mwahaha. But then there's also, you know, the party scene with Garrett... not Garrett Morris. I've got black comics on my mind. Garrett Graham, with Garrett Graham in the gorilla suit. It's like, it's just a party full of hippies. So of course there's, you know, like this one stone guy with Coke bottle glasses and a beard talking about the ice cream that he wants to eat because he's stoned, man. He's got the munchies.
Well, or the when they're driving around and they're like, I'll take you home, baby, and I'll make you an avocado sandwich. Like, won't that be great? And then later on, the girl's like, well, I want an avocado with
bean sprouts or something.
Well, yeah, but he's like, and no bacon. And she's like, of course not. But after she's sad, she's like, I really kind of like bacon. And it's like, see, they're not – hippies are really okay. Hippie kids are really okay. And you're just, it's just – it's this weird mix of like
– It's post-Nixon hippie backlash humor, basically. 1972, of course, the year of the greatest landslide in American history up to that point for Nixon. It's kind of – it's a real portrait of 1972, Beware the Blob is.
And I think that's why I feel like somebody should actually take the time to restore this thing. I mean, Larry Hagman's dead, of course. But, you know, Larry Hagman went on to, you know, to Dallas and pretty much just that, right? So, like, that's all he's going to be remembered for, not being a jackass right. on I Dream of Jeannie. or this period where apparently, like, he just, like, you know, hanging out in L.A. and, like, making an improv movie with his friends. Then it's this weird thing, and it's unfortunate that it actually didn't get – it's one of those things where you're like, I bet the making of's more interesting than the movie, just – because it's so many weird things thrown together at once.
Yeah, so many weird people thrown together.
Who's the guy? He's been on like 30 sitcoms, but who's the guy who plays the bowling alley owner?
I wish I hadn't just closed the IMDb page, but yeah. You know what? Let's talk about that guy for a second while we remember / find his name, because – like you said, we find out eventually that he's the bowling alley owner. But before that, like for the first hour of the movie or something, there's just this terrible running gag where the two, you know, the young hippie couple keeps they're driving away. The girl is driving away from the scene of the crime where Godfrey's been eaten by the blob, and she sideswipes him. And then she's like driving back and she knocks over his groceries. And then her boyfriend is driving and like the guy recognizes the car and he runs over his groceries. And you're just like, why do we keep cutting back to this guy? Or, you know, you think it's just a dumb running gag. But then it's like, no, actually it turns out that he owns the bowling alley where the climax happens. And, you know, the blob attacking the bowling alley is kind of repetition of the blob attacking the movie theater in the original. But, you know, the fact that this movie was improvised probably just means that when it came time to shoot the bowling alley sequence, they were like, you know, hey, you want to be the owner too? And we can keep you in all the way to the end here. Richard Stahl as Edward Fazio.
And I'm pretty sure his name.
A character who says his name a lot. So that you remember.
So he basically, his movie career, he's one of those guys who was on a lot of sitcoms. He was on...
much like everyone in this movie.
But I think he's kind of just on everything starting in 1972. With Love American Style. He's pretty much on every show you can think of between All in the Family, Good Times, tons of appearances on The Odd Couple, Maude, Happy Days. I mean, there's just anything you could have seen him on in a rerun. I think I remember him from he was on the Bob Newhart show as a bellboy at one point. That's kind of weird. He was on WKRP, the pilot. That's what I remembered him from. He's really distinctive. And I'd say, 25% of his lines for a while work in like a dumb sitcom-y way. But then he just starts failing. Like everything else on this. Was he ever on... It appears he never was on Three's Company, though, which is what the show reminds me, or the movie reminds me.
Yeah. We're running out of time to talk about Beware the Blob, so I just want to mention two more things. Number one, the special effects aren't bad, considering like how obviously micro-budgeted this was. I mean, I guess they look, you know, except for the fact that there's no establishing shots of the blob because they can't afford miniatures to put, you know, a jello mold in front of a miniature of a bowling alley, say. Besides that, they don't look bad. There's these kind of cool blob cam shots where they've got, but they clearly had like a big tube of blob looking stuff that they were just rolling in front of the camera and moving it towards people. And that's the shot where the priest is holding up the cross to it and to no avail. There's also kind of a memorable shot when the blob is attacking the bowling alley where they did have one miniature. They created a miniature of bowling alley lanes so that they could have blob goo shoot out of them so that like it's coming towards the camera out from the end of the bowling alley lanes where the pins are set. That's just a memorable shot to me for some reason. And the other thing I guess that's worth mentioning, the only other thing worth mentioning about Beware the Blob is that when it was re-released or, you know, re-released on video or shown on television or whatever in the early 80s, they gave it the tagline, the film that JR shot.
Funny. Yeah. So, beware the blob. No, I'd like to see what was going on. I feel like I'm a curmudgeon-y, like, it's like a Peter Hames movie. I can't see what's going on, you know? It, just because it, some of the swipes you want to take at it, you feel like you can't just because it's, like, so cheap.
Yeah, it definitely didn't take itself seriously enough to really, like, dig into it. But, hey, it's got a little bit of charm. I mean, okay, if you're going to do anything, just watch the opening 10 minutes for the song and to watch the blob attack a kitten and know that Dean Koondy was helping make that happen.
But, yeah, so – and Cindy Williams is actually really funny. For her scene, but yeah.
I didn't even notice that, you know, when they're talking about an avocado sandwich, that's a swipe at hippies. Like, I heard that dialogue, and I just thought, yeah, an avocado sandwich sounds good right now.
Okay, but yeah, so we'll move on to the non-hippie blob remake.
And you know what's kind of, amazing about the three blob movies? First of all, maybe it's not so amazing that there are only three blob movies because it's a pretty elaborate special effect. You know, a pretty abstract kind of monster to create. You can't just have a guy in a suit. But the original Blob and then Beware the Blob and Blob 88, they're about 15 years apart from each other, and each one really couldn't be more different. Like I mentioned before, all three of them are produced by Jack Harris. So Blob 88, I'd seen it once before as a teenager on video, and I remember it being entertaining but not really memorable. Like, the most memorable thing about it is how good the special effects are. And I gotta say, that's still exactly how I feel now. Special effects are memorable, but I want to say that it's missing something, but I don't really know if there's anything to the blob beyond the special effect of the blob itself. One of the taglines for Blob 88 kind of hints at something more. It's like, if it had a face, you could stare it in the eye. If it had, you know, kind of like emphasizing its inhuman nature. And there is something kind of, you know, to use a cliched literary adjective, Lovecraftian, about the idea of just, you know, a thing from space that's practically just, you know, an organism or a germ that, you know, consumes humanity, just because that's what, you know, germs do, is they consume other life forms. I mean, you know, Lovecraft wrote The Color Out of Space, which is about, you know, a blobby thing coming down on a meteorite and poisoning everything around it. But Blob 88 doesn't, you know, try to get intellectual about it or anything. It makes like one attempt when these government agents show up and they're telling the kids, like, you know, we think that, you know, this might have been what killed the dinosaurs back then, because, you know, a meteorite hit the Earth and then suddenly the dinosaurs were gone almost immediately. But then they negate that later when it's revealed that the blob was a biological weapon created to, you know, kill the Russians. Which makes no freaking sense, because how are you going to send the blob to Russia? It's cold in Russia. This was co-written by Academy Award winner Frank Darabont. He didn't think of that, you know.
Yeah, the science angle in this one is pretty weak. One of the things that I noticed about it this time that I guess I wouldn't have occurred to me the first time I saw it, because I first saw it, I like rented it on video, and I was like, because I'd always heard it was really bad, because I don't think it did well.
No, I was surprised to see that, but yeah, it was like made for 20 million and made a little less than 10, something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, it had
And that was at a time, you know, even in the late 80s, when like really special effects heavy movies were around 10 million in terms of production. So like, this was pretty high budgeted, and it really shows, because the blob looks fantastic. But yeah, it bombed pretty bad.
And yeah, that's why Chuck Russell didn't make a movie until what, The Mask or whatever. But and we already did the Invaders from Mars episode, so I mean, it's sort of the same thing. Is that it's,
yeah, it's part of that milieu of 50s monster and sci-fi movies,
right,
being made, which you'd think was set off by John Carpenter's The Thing, but that was a huge bomb too. What it was really set off by was The Fly remake from Cronenberg, which, by the way, I checked, cost less to make than the Blob remake.
I think that was so the only hit.
So that's
these.
How. Yeah, it was. that was the only hit, and it also cost less than the Blob, but you wouldn't really know it watching it.
But this is, I think, your first post-Aliens female hero.
Yeah, you get a really strong Ripley, the lasting effect of Ripley vibe when Shawnee Smith is firing a machine gun at the blob, yelling, is that the best you've got?
Yeah.
It's like, come on, she was a cheerleader yesterday. Like,
she toughens up really quick, and I mean,
she's protecting two little kids from the blob.
Doesn't
so there's
do that
her,
good of a job though.
No, there's her Ripley maternal warrior woman thing. And yeah, the blob eats one of those kids.
Yeah.
Shockingly. They killed a kid. You always got to give points for that.
They killed a kid, and he was an annoying '80s Walkman kid.
Like, not only do they kill him, but you see him all half digested in the blob, like a few seconds later.
And I think that's one of the things I remember about the original Blob, is that it didn't get particularly gross after the initial guy's hand thing. In the original one, and this one finally realized all the grossness. Like, I don't know if you read the trivia too, but they didn't tell her that the guy who gets killed at the beginning, they didn't tell her it was a dummy in there, and so she actually thought he was suffocating in the makeup, and they were like, yeah, that'll get a good reaction shot out of her. And it's just like, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The grossness, do you think maybe the grossness is part of why this was a bomb? I mean, I know that sounds stupid to say for an 80s horror movie, but like the thing about 80s horror movies and the grossness of the gore and the kind of proliferation of the gore is that, you know, in Friday – you know, compared to like Friday the 13th movies or even Nightmare on Elm Street movies or, you know, the Halloween franchise, like those movies never really got as explicit as, say, Evil Dead or, you know, something that was maybe a little more under the radar. But this, you know, this was like, you know, a big wide release movie. And considering that, it has like insanely disgusting stuff in it, because pretty much every time the blob eats somebody, you watch them melt. You watch them, you know, their face melt off, or you watch them get digested, or you see them fall apart. And it happens to a kid at one point. It's like pretty intense, disturbing stuff, I would think, for most people. You know, even for like 80s audiences who are maybe used to Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees, this is kind of like more queasy than those types of movies.
It's realizing the queasiness that nobody ever got explicit with in like a Lovecraftian sense. Like the crawling eye from the 50s or the 60s?
Yeah.
Was it the crawling eye? Oh, no, the Trollenberg Terror.
That's the same movie.
Is it? Okay, yeah, where the fog and terrible things happen to you in the cold fog. This realizes that in a way that it lacks personality. It doesn't have the personality of the Freddy Krueger. It doesn't have the vaguely comedic Jason stuff going on.
It's very kind of jovial. I mean, like right from the beginning, it's, you know, setting up this small town of colorful characters and stuff. And it's not like incompetently done stuff, but it never quite sticks. It's really hard to care about any of the characters, especially because Shawnee Smith and Kevin Dillon are kind of bland, and Shawnee Smith, you know, the cheerleader turned Ripley that we mentioned, it's like her love interest co-star hero in this is Kevin Dillon as this really lame James Dean type, you know, he's like the bad boy of this small town. So he's got this awful 80s mullet and he rides around on a motorcycle. It's kind of hard to care about him. They're pretty bland.
Yeah, and well, I feel like the other reason that it probably
who has more personality actually is Candy Clark as the waitress. It was kind of sad.
Yeah.
It was kind of sad to see her get eaten in the phone booth by a blob,
exactly.
Even though it's a great scene.
And there's the whole.
I wish the movie had been about her.
There's that whole arc with her and the sheriff flirting with each other and stuff like that. And it just turns into them both getting eaten by the blob, her rather explicitly and him showing up half eaten. And I wonder if that didn't turn people off. Well, no, it wouldn't have turned off the regular audience, except, you know, it's like Invaders from Mars. Invaders from Mars had that thing where Tobe Hooper was only trying to appeal to people who wanted to see an update of the original. This one was trying to do both. It was trying to be like, well, you saw the original, and so you're of this certain age group where you want to see Candy Clark in a movie. Well, then you kill her off in this. It's pretty,
yeah.
It's pretty, that sequence is pretty, pretty tense, because she's escaping. You think she's going to make it. And they already have established that it's one of those no one is safe movies where the Johnny Smith's first love interest gets eaten.
Mm-hmm.
The third build guy gets eaten, you know, not that far into it.
So, yeah, I mean, and what makes the movie work is that, like, those scenes are really exciting. And when the blob is chasing people around, it's actually, you know, on the whole, it, you know, you could make the argument that it's a better kind of monster 80s, you know, special effects movie monster than The Thing. And they do really similar things to The Thing in that, you know, it leaps up and grabs onto the ceiling and it's got lots of tentacles that whip all over the place. But it's even grosser than The Thing in terms of what you see happen to people. I mean, yeah, it's gross in The Thing when, you know, it wraps around the dog. But in The Blob 88, it's like doing that same thing to people every 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, and I think that that's why the tense pacing is why you're able to overlook the blandness, is because that I'm thinking about that scene. Okay, so when Candy Clark dies, it's when it attacks the diner.
Mm-hmm.
And Shawnee Smith and Kevin Dillon have a really lame conversation about something. Him not believing her, something like that. But then they're like sort of escape from the blob where they get separated from Candy Clark. It's Candy Clark.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They all of a sudden become very sympathetic. And when they're stuck in the cooler, and what is it? He's going to attack the blob with his hook. You know, they don't play that for humor at all. They're able to keep the tension ratcheted up. And then it cuts to Candy Clark trying to escape. Then it cuts back to them trying to figure out if they can leave. And then there's this weird thing where they disappear and somebody comes to the diner to check on it and finds it unlocked. Remember that? Like it like cuts ahead a bit.
Well, isn't it? Oh, I remember. It's Del Close. He's back.
That's right, Del Close. he couldn't stay away from the blob. He's playing an alcoholic preacher who he's the alcoholic town preacher.
Mm-hmm. And it's a much larger role than the one scene he has in Beware the Blob. But I guess him and Jack Harris were just friends. It's the only explanation for why he's back in this one. Yeah, he comes back to the diner. He finds a chip off the old blob and he puts it in a jar. And then the last shot of the movie is the setup for the sequel that never happened, where he's got it in a jar and he's clearly suffering some kind of radiation poisoning from it. And he's mumbling about, you know, he's waiting for a sign from God to let it loose again.
Yeah.
Del Close, not really in that many movies. He was in several episodes of the Upright Citizens Brigade sketch comedy show on Comedy Central in the late 90s, early 2000s. But that's because, you know, he mentored those guys.
So what else happens in this movie?
The blob, well, it's a tribute to the original on the level that the blob attacks a movie theater.
That is a really freaky ass sequence because possibly for budgetary reasons, but Chuck Russell does a pretty good job with this movie. They do with strobe lights and it just freaks you the hell out because you just cut to terrible things happening to people.
Yeah,
terrible, terrible things.
Well, it sort of reminds of The Thing and how well, you know, the shadows and flickering lights and stuff made The Thing seem more real in that one. And I'm thinking of, like, you know, the scene where it's in the dog kennel, where it's, you know, and they're shining the flashlights on it. The scene in the theater is great. And the scene in the theater also has a movie parody within a movie of slasher movies. It's like Power Tool Massacre or something, and you know, they set it up at the beginning of the movie that Shawnee Smith's little brother wants to go see it, and you know, it's like, you know, it's okay, Mom, you know, lots of people get killed but there's no nudity. And it would be, you know, it'd be okay if Chuck Russell wanted to get all self-righteous about that kind of thing. But you know what he came off of before he made this? He directed Nightmare on Elm Street 3, which, okay, admittedly, you know, with the surreal imagery and the special effects, it's more high concept than a Jason movie. But still, it's like, you know, why is this, you know, is it a joke on slasher movie fans for the benefit of the classical monster movie fans who are supposed to be this movie's audience?
Well,
I guess so.
I don't know. It's also a year after Monster Squad, which does the exact same thing.
Oh, right. A fake slasher movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And with the same sort of you know, is this a movie for the classic monster fan, the Monster Squad, or is it, you know, the PG version of the modern?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Another good chase sequence in this movie is when they're running through the sewers. That's the scene where the blob catches up with one of the two kids.
Yeah.
But then suddenly Kevin Dillon is there with his motorcycle. He somehow squeezed it down a manhole, and then he and Shawnee Smith ride to safety around the pipe.
That's the big Ripley moment. And I feel like that's the real problem with the movie is that by throwing in the government agency who's immediately there to look at this, especially since the guy who plays the lead scientist is just awful.
Joe Seneca.
Yeah. Wasn't he coming off of like Crossroads or something? That movie with Ralph Macchio that everybody liked back in the '80s. He got the "and" credit in this one. It's like, as opposed to it being James Earl Jones, it's kind of the Morgan Freeman role of the blob, but yeah, he's really bad. And that whole subplot is just terrible. And it sort of takes over the end of the movie.
Yeah. And it takes away from the blob to just have it be explained that it's a government project gone awry. I mean, isn't the blob cooler if it just came down from a meteorite from outer space?
No, this was the 80s. You know, we explained everything. They explained everything. Then they didn't for a while. And then thanks to Batman Begins, they explain everything again. Or whatever that line is, that if you wanted to believe that was why girls didn't like the Tim Burton Batman movies, was because it didn't explain where he got the Batmobile. Which
who's saying that girls, that was why girls didn't
that's
like
that's what they said in like the Batman, the sort of pre-Batman Begins, was that was one of the reasons they felt like
it's because men innately understand why Batman is Batman and they don't need it explained.
Yeah, it's the post Spider-Man's audience was half female type thing.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, but we always manage to bring it back to Batman, don't we?
Only the Tim Burtons. Have we talked about John Carpenter? Oh, The Thing. What else do we need to talk about in here to really make it an Alan Smithy podcast? What? Yeah, so that's really the big problem.
RoboCop.
When people
get melted in the blob, it kind of looks like what happens to Emil Antonowski.
You're stretching.
You can check the RoboCop box now on your scorecard.
Yeah, you're stretching with that one. There's no crossover cast either. It's really disjointed and. It raises the question is how good could a blob movie possibly be?
Yeah, and I kind of – that's what I was saying at the beginning. It's just like I want to believe that there is a better blob movie that could be made. Maybe not. Maybe the best parts of the original and the best parts of the remake and one or two things from Beware the Blob, like having it eat a kitten – are about the best components that you could throw together. I think the only thing people really took away from the Blob 88 is the scene where it drags a guy down a That seems to be what people always take away from this.
That's a pretty rough one. Yeah.
I think it's because what came out the year before this, that segment of Creepshow 2, that's like the Blob on a raft. You ever see Creepshow 2?
No.
Well, Creepshow 2 has like one – it's got three segments and two of them suck, but – okay, that's not true. All right. There's a segment in Creepshow 2 where some kids are on a raft on a lake and there's something in the water. And at first they think it's an oil slick, but then pretty quickly they discover that it's a blob type thing that eats them much like the blob would. So they're stuck on this raft. And it's actually really good. It's suspenseful. And when the Blob thing eats the kids, it's as horrific as anything in the Blob 88. So I don't know if that really, you know, played a part in the making of this movie, but maybe people had their fill on blobs eating teenagers because of Creepshow 2 the year before this. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, it was hitting the end of the 80s and sort of the end of the 80s horror heyday.
Yeah, I think it was 88 was kind of the peak of it. It was all downhill after this. After this, you've got, you know, the dream. Freddy has the dream child, and Jason goes to Manhattan, and that's the end of it, right there. And the MPAA. The other thing is, like, the MPAA was really starting to crack down on the violence and gore in horror movies, so it's kind of unbelievable that this has as much gore in it as it does. I guess maybe the MPAA figured it was just, you know, so ridiculous that they didn't, you know, nobody would be taking it seriously, or they didn't take it seriously. But, you know, it's not like this was released unrated or anything. It had an R rating. But it's, you know, way the hell gorier than a lot of other, you know, movies that got cut down for content around this time.
Yeah.
It's a really explicitly gory, gross movie. Have I conveyed this yet? am I getting this information across to you?
You know what? There's not a lot of blood, though. Maybe that's what it was. I don't think
I guess so. Yeah.
There's no blood except on the hobo at the beginning. Otherwise, the blob consumes everybody, so there's no time for blood.
Yeah, but it's so gross. Like in the movie theater scene, like, you know, Shawnee Smith like sees somebody laying on the ground.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and she turns the woman over and her face is half eaten. It's hideous.
Oh, that was gross. Yeah.
Okay, so if you're a quote unquote gore hound, yeah, by all means, please see this movie. I wish I could recommend it on a level more than that, but it's really just something that you see for how impressive the gore effects were. Okay, but besides the gore, the blob itself is like really impressive. It's a combination of, you know, miniatures and forced perspective and you know, some puppetry and stuff. But the blob comes across as like this living thing and a really elaborate, you know, special effect. I mean, you get your wide shots in this at the end of the movie when it's like wreaking havoc through the town. You get your wide shots, but the funny thing is, it doesn't have much of a personality. I mean, it's the blob and everything, but you know, in the original Blob and in Beware the Blob, it's just a mass that slowly moves towards you, and it's like by having so much better special effects in the Blob 88, they kind of had the opportunity to give it more personality. But it doesn't really. And again, to take it back to Carpenter's The Thing, I mean, Carpenter's The Thing, well, maybe it's because Carpenter's The Thing has faces on it, you know, like the Norris monster, when it's the Norris monster and so forth, that it has more of a personality. But yeah, it's hard to be a monster with a personality when you don't have a face.
And the scientific explanation probably takes some of that away from it too. Because when we say it takes over the movie, there's a 5 or 6 minute scene toward the end where the evil scientist is arguing that they need to shoot the kids or leave the kids down underground.
Yeah, they're going to quarantine the town. And what about the civilians? They're expendable and all that.
And then the regular army's like flipping out, and it's just such a distraction from the movie. And yeah,
it's a distraction from the characters we already don't care about. So spending more time away from them just makes it even more dull when we come back to them.
Right, because when you get back to them, they're taking care of the...
They're just, you know, evading the blob.
Yeah, and there's some stuff where they try to... The town bands together to fight the blob, but there weren't really any divisions. It's just... Yeah, it's... The science angle of it does not do it any favors, which I think is sort of the standard rule for a remake, is that when you try to explain it scientifically, you just are wasting your time.
Yeah. You know, Frank Darabont, everybody knows him for writing Shawshank Redemption, but he pretty much got to that point and stayed in that area of Stephen King adaptations for most of his career. But he co-wrote Nightmare on Elm Street 3 with Chuck Russell.
Did he really? This. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, they were a team. Well, and Wes Craven. But it was like I think he rewrote Craven's script or something like that. But Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is like a brilliant character study compared to the characters in The Blob. And we're just talking about like teenagers who die according to the gimmicks of their phobias here. And The Blob can't even match that. Probably the best character moment in The Blob is the vignette near the beginning of the movie where the jock goes to buy condoms.
Yes. Yeah.
And the pharmacist, and then when he goes to Shawnee Smith's house, Shawnee Smith's dad is the pharmacist who sold him the condoms, which is like one of those old urban legend type of jokes that everybody knows.
Yeah.
One more thing I'll say for The Blob remake. Apparently it was filmed on location in some town in Louisiana. I've never seen a real town look more like a backlot town than the one that The Blob was filmed in.
It's got a town square. It's got, it's kind of perfect for,
it looks like Hill Valley or something, but it's real.
You got to wonder if they when they were doing location shoot, scouting, they picked that cause they knew it would be easy to replicate in the miniatures.
Yeah, very likely.
It makes you wonder though, how long they spent on it. Cause this was the '80s. They were miniatures. And they're good miniatures. So who knows when principal photography on The Blob was? Because it's not like they could have turned around and done this in.
Yeah,
three
I mean,
months. You know, yeah.
Yeah, they might have. Yeah, they might have started making this Chuck Russell and Frank Darabont. That is like right after Nightmare 3, the year before.
Yeah.
Well,
you know.
Recommended for the special effects and sadly nothing else. But hey, you know, it's pretty amazing stuff on the special effects front. Worth seeing just for that.
When you realize there are no computers involved whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and for Chuck Del Close completists. Fans of improv comedy and The Second City and all that.
Yeah, if you're gonna see Beware the Blob, you kind of have to follow it up with that. And it's it's part of that '80s.
The '80s throwback to '50s monster movies, but on '80s horror movie terms that actually like works on every level. It also came out in 1988. It's Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Well,
like that takes the structure of movies like The Blob, and it does it in a way that only would have been done in the '80s. And the special effects are pretty pretty inventive and funny. And it actually has a lot of charm.
I was actually, it also is that sort of mid to late 80s, sort of the box office bombs from the studios were a lot more interesting than the hits.
Mm-hmm.
Type thing. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a curiosity. I don't know. I read that they're going to release a Twilight Time, which is the Screen Archives exclusive Blu-ray label. They're going to be releasing this on Blu-ray next year. And I couldn't figure out why, because the score is completely unmemorable. The score from...
Oh, yeah, the music is very, very generic.
Michael Honig. And, yeah, it's going to have its own isolated audio track for this score. And I was like, why? But, whatever.
Yeah. Well, we're not straying too far from the horror genre for our next episode. We're going to be taking a look at the original The Invisible Man from, I think, 34 or 33, but it's directed by James Whale, and it's a classic. It rules, and the special effects are like still amazing to this day, which is not something you could say for very many movies of the 1930s. You know, maybe like King Kong and one or two others have special effects that are still kind of magical today. And then we're going to follow that up with a really not so magical Invisible Man movie with, you know, better special effects, but oh boy, it's really, that can't save it. It's Memoirs of an Invisible Man, the John Carpenter movie that nobody remembers, and rightfully so. And we haven't talked about it since the first episode of an Alan Smithy podcast when we reviewed John Carpenter's whole career. So this will be kind of a homecoming.
Yeah.
And that'll be the next episode. So, Andrew, would you care to plug your other podcast?
Oh, yes. My other podcast is the Comics Fondle podcast, which you can easily get to at comicsfondle.com. And it's just comic book talk. No special features, really. No special emphases, just blathering about comic books.
Yeah, and your co-host actually like owns a comic book store, right?
Yes, my co-host owns a comic book shop, so
he knows what he's talking about.
He knows what he's talking about, and there's an interesting mix just because he didn't read mainstream comics in the 90s, and I did, so...
Oh, so all of your Image references just go completely over his head.
I don't actually have any.
you're talking about like Bad Company and stuff, and he just doesn't know.
I don't even get that one. Okay, late 80s comic book stuff that he doesn't know. Yeah, no, it's an interesting mix of stuff, especially since now it's very hard to get excited about comics. Mainstream comics, anyway.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Well, we hope you'll join us for the Invisible Man episode. That's the first Friday of November. So come on back and listen. And for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.